Hi, everyone. We're going to start now. Sorry for starting 5 minutes late. For those of you who've kind of received mixed messages, apologies for that. We seem to have a problem with our mailing system where we sent things out before British Standard Time changed, and that seems to have carried over for a bit. So we'll expect a few more people to join online, but I think we're kind of there now here in the room. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Syed Hadley. I'm a senior research fellow here at ODI. And, you know, I'm really sort of thrilled that we can kind of host this event today. It's part of a series that we're starting that's looking at how finance ministries in different countries engage with policy. And it feels like the U.K. is a kind of sort of an opportune country or a kind of useful country to start that conversation off with, because sort of, you know, on one level, it's you know, often held up as the kind of stereotype or kind of the model of a modern treasury. It's both kind of powerful. Politically, it combines the kind of functions for finance and for economics. And it's been one of the countries that's been very active in embracing sort of the various best practices of public financial management reforms over the years. It's also a really, really excellent opportunity to be making use of this excellent book, The Way the Money Goes, which has been sort of written by Christopher Hood, Maya King, Barbara Piotrowska, and Ian McLean. And it, you know, it's, I think it's not often that we get a chance to really kind of delve into depth of you know, in the history in a kind of case. We kind of hear sort of, you know, a snapshot in time, or we kind of hear a kind of, you know, a specific part of the story. And this is a really kind of holistic look at a kind of very critical period in the Treasury's history in the U.K. And that's, I think, I think that's particularly of interest for an international audience for basically for two reasons. So one is that it was really during this period that many of the kind of modern ideas of public financial management have been kind of instituted and implemented. So when we talk about the U.K. as being a model, it's often the reforms that have been introduced during this period that tend to be kind of picked up on, whether that's sort of issues around the introduction of sort of stronger top-down budgeting or accrual accounting, fixed medium-term budgets. These kind of issues, they all kind of were introduced in these times. And I think the second is that it offers a really kind of interesting period to look at how politics also shapes spending review, the kind of spending control process. So it's not just about the tools, but also how these kind of interact with the kind of institutions and the politics and the context of the day. So just to give, for those of you who don't know the U.K. context that well, I don't think that applies so much to the people in the room, but maybe for some of you online. I mean, the period from 1992 and up to around 97 was a kind of Conservative-led government, was very much kind of in the mode of kind of trying to control and reduce public spending. From 1997 up until 2010, we had a new Labour government. The new Labour government, you know, in a large part, at least up until the global financial crisis, was sort of more in the mode of improving public services and increasing public spending. And then from 2010 to 2015, we had the kind of end of this period of the book. There was a coalition government, and the coalition government had introduced a kind of very significant package of austerity measures in the wake of the global financial crisis. So to help us kind of walk through all that very long and very complicated history and that very rich history, Christopher Hood is here, and he's going to try and give us a sort of a help distill some of the kind of key findings of the book. Christopher is a visiting professor at Blavatnik School of Government, Oxford, and is widely known, you know, to many of you and to us as you know, for his work on public administration in the U.K. But beyond just looking at the U.K., you know, we wouldn't be at ODI if we weren't thinking also about what's happening elsewhere and the implications elsewhere. And so to help us do that, I've got two people joining us online. I've got Andrew Donaldson and Yasmin Hurchan. And Andrew Donaldson is now a research associate at the University of Cape Town. But previously, he was in the South African Treasury, and he was the inaugural head of the Government Technical Advisory Centre. So this was the kind of unit that helped support the South African Treasury with its kind of public finance reforms. Yasmin Hurchan is an IMF regional public financial management advisor. She's based in Ljubljana with the Centre for Excellence in Finance. And her work serves essentially the kind of Southeast Europe region. But before that, she was in both in IMF headquarters and was for 16 years in Turkey's finance ministry, or treasury, sorry, working on public financial management reforms in the early 2000s. So just with that kind of broad context, I think basically the way we're going to try and run this, I've got a sort of, we're going to do this fairly informally. I'm going to try and kick off with Christopher, with Yasmin, and with Andrew, some kind of just general questions to get the conversation started. And then hopefully we'll kind of kick it over to both the kind of in-person audience for like lots of questions and comments and kind of interjections. But also for those of you who are online, you won't be able to unmute yourselves, but if you've got a question, please put it in the Q&A. And I've got a nice iPad here, which I'll try and monitor the questions, and kind of we can feed them through into the conversation and try and group them together. So with that, thanks very much for joining. Thanks, Christopher, for making the time. Same for Yasmin and Andrew. We really appreciate it. Let me start with a kind of first question, which is sort of going not quite to the kind of core title of the book, but at least kind of part of it, which is, so for those of us who work in public financial management, I don't think I've seen the term fiscal constitution used very often in a way. And I was kind of wondering, why did you pick that as a kind of concept to use and as an anchor? And in the book, you did kind of lay out some of the kind of more permanent features of that fiscal constitution. Maybe you could kind of give us at least a kind of brief insight into what those are.
Yes. Hello, everyone. Sorry, I was almost late. I'd forgotten where this place was, but I made it just about on time. Yes, the fiscal constitution. My colleagues, Barbara and Mayakan, had their own versions of this, but it came about, I think it's explained on page 15 of the book, chapter one, that we took it from the excellent work of Martin Daunton, and I would recommend that to any public financial management specialist. He wrote a brilliant economic history of how the tax system developed in the U.K. in the 19th century and also in the 20th century. And it's built around this idea of a fiscal constitution, a set of practices, attitudes, institutions that in some sense fit together and make a set. Also, the one team member who's not present today, Ian MacLean, had written about the constitutional aspects of sub-state relationships, comparatively speaking. He's one of the world experts on all that. And for him, that's also a key aspect of constitutional analysis. So that's why we took that concept. We thought that it was useful to look at various practices that and institutions that in some sense form a set. And that's what we introduce in chapter two when we go into some of the enduring features of the way that the U.K. does public spending control or did at the time of writing of the book. Is that enough to get us started? Perhaps Barbara and Maya might like to come in.
And I mean, so I mean, maybe then, yes, I mean, certainly that's really useful. I mean, I guess the question is with the seven features, I mean, would you mind being kind of just saying kind of what they are?
Yes, of course I can. We identified seven features that were relatively enduring. I'd have to say relatively enduring, because little changes are happening all the time. And the first one we had is what I guess anyone, particularly from other European countries, would notice, namely the fact that the fiscal constitution is only partly codified. There are lots of rules of one kind or another, standing orders of the House of Commons, statutes, treasury rules and the like. But there isn't really a single place where it all comes together. There's no equivalent of organic law or American constitution. And that's the first thing that I think anyone from overseas picks up about the U.K. system. The second feature that we talk about, hang on, I'm going to need to get this. The second thing that we observed is a long-standing practice of Parliament's behaviour in relation to spending control, namely with much more attention and expertise in the parliamentary sphere in the form of 800 or so officials from the National Audit Office advising and servicing probably the most important parliamentary committee, the public the public expenditure committee, and that's a case where Parliament has got 800 auditors servicing a committee looking at things that have been problematic mostly. So there's a big ex post bias in the parliamentary system. And by contrast, very splendid resources that go into looking at prospective expenditure plans. Again, that's much commented on. I think it's probably true to some extent. I defer to the comparative experts. In all Western European parliaments, there is that kind of bias, but it's certainly marked in this case. And then there is what Ian McLean has written about, that is the vertical fiscal gap between what is spent and what taxes are raised at different levels of government, where again, the UK has historically had a very, very large fiscal gap between those two, really slowly changing, but not very much. And with formula funding arrangements, both for local government and for devolved territorial government. And we have a whole chapter that we devote to that. We have then a spending review process that aims to be comprehensive and aims to have synchronized competitive reviews of spending across the whole public sector, which again, I wouldn't want to say that that's that's only done in this country, but it's certainly been a marked feature of the system, at least since the Plowden report of the early 60s, and never quite disappeared. Then we've got what Sia just mentioned, a system that formally comprises a top-down fixed envelope approach to spending allocation, i.e. the idea that the cabinet has to first decide on the size of the overall fiscal envelope before you then have a zero-sum game to get at components of that. Again, it doesn't work always like that. There you'll find various examples in the book where that principle is dramatically breached, but that's something that is a feature of the system, and certainly some of our interviewees, many who had been around over the whole period of our book, The Old Stages, thought that was the most important feature of the budget management system in the UK and the most important change that had occurred over our period. And then we have what's known as the Haldane principle, which is that the spending bids by departments are reviewed by the department that's responsible for levying taxes. An idea that you'll find in the 1919 Reconstruction Committee, when a number of individuals were looking at how to reorganize the government after the First World War. And that was the Haldane Committee, and we call that the Haldane Principle. You bring taxes and expenditure under a single roof. You make the same minister responsible for both taxing and expenditure. And that's arguably a way of bringing those discussions together. And then finally, we've got the famous porthole principle, which is that at the centre of the finance ministry, you have a small unit that's responsible for making overall plans and working the spreadsheets that the Treasury has for every expenditure review. But around that system, you also have a set of teams, as they're now called. They used to be called divisions, monitoring and interacting with individual departments or groups of departments. And the idea is that that way you get a mixture of a bird's eye view from the central unit, the GEP, General Expenditure Policy Division.
Sorry, I'm late.
And on the other hand, you get you get knowledge of departments from the departmentally specific teams, and those two units are in tension to some extent. Although I came across one Treasury document that described it as like military organization, like the distinction between a general staff and line regiments, and that person seemed to think that was the kind of comparison. So those are the seven elements that we picked out as relatively enduring, relatively distinctive about this constitution. And as you can see, they take us out, not always, but they go beyond looking at the Treasury alone. You're looking at the relationships between the different actors in the system, Parliament, departments, etc. So that's what we mean by a constitution, and that's what we mean by the seven elements that go into it. Again, I'll turn over to my colleagues. What have I missed?
No, thanks. That's super, and I think it's really, really helpful to kind of get that kind of bigger picture. And I think it's also, couple of things I thought were like a real reflection for me. One is the inclusion of local government kind of very centrally in this kind of concept. I think that is quite a different thing than we would tend to do in our kind of space. So, depends on who you talk to. And the other is the kind of description of the porthole principle is, again, something that's sort of fairly broad and enduring, but not something that is necessarily kind of described or actually talked about all that much in the public finance literature. Again, sort of just very notable. I mean, switching sort of less to the kind of permanent features, but also to the kind of what makes this period so distinctive and so interesting for like this group and for the people online is that kind of, it was, you know, 1992 kind of marks the beginning of essentially a kind of, at least a kind of an internal view that the kind of Treasury's approach to spending control and the kind of way the organization is structured is different. I mean, Mike is here from, and sort of we were just catching up a minute ago, and he was kind of part of the fundamental expenditure review in that period. So in that sense, you know, it's often kind of referred to as a kind of really clear break. And I used to work at the Treasury very briefly, and I'm pretty sure that if I was to join pre-fundamental expenditure review and post-fundamental expenditure review, or at least in the 2010s when I was there, that these organizations would have looked and felt quite different. But yet what I think would be interesting to hear is, with all that kind of modernization, with the new tools that were brought in, with the new approaches to public expenditure management and organization, like how do you think that actually changed public spending? And it's a kind of big question, but I suppose it goes to the heart of kind of what your book was trying to kind of tease out.
Well, while Barbara and Maya are thinking up their answers to this, let me have a try first. I think one of the things that we do that does come out from the interviews that we did for this book is that we didn't really see a move towards public spending control by algorithms. Virtually all of the people that we interviewed who were in the thick of it for settling public expenditure emphasized. I made a few quotes actually from this, which will give you the flavor of the kind of thing they said, if I can find it. It was things like, it's politics, not rules, that determine outcomes. It's all about people and personalities. I remember another interviewee pressing this point, and that was very much a feature of the process. The one interesting exception is precisely the devolved government aspect of it, where you have a system intended to be temporary that had been set up in the 1970s ahead of a referendum on devolution to Scotland and Wales, which was expected to produce a yes vote. And that took an even older formula, the Goschen formula, which goes back to the 19th century. And really, although devolution didn't get a yes vote back in 1978, was it? 77 or 78. In spite of the fact that we had big changes in politics in Scotland and to a lesser extent Wales, certainly in Northern Ireland, these ancient and supposedly temporary formulae, much criticised by all the professoriate, have nevertheless survived even into the age of nationalist parties in Scotland, who want independence. They've still stuck to the the formula, the Barnett formula. So that's a case where, as one very distinguished Treasury civil servant put it, we'd set up these arrangements so that politicians didn't have to talk to one another. And I thought that was a sort of interesting perspective on why that had survived and why it had continued in spite of the political changes. So although there's lots of politics going on, interestingly, in this one bit of the area, it doesn't look quite like that. It looks as if they've stayed with the inertia, much criticised system. Can I just say one other thing about your point about the fact that sub-state finance is a big feature of this book? That's not accidental. We were determined that this book should be different from Heckler and Wodowski's book, which hardly mentions that aspect of spending control, and from the much more thorough book by Thane and Wright in 1995, which is a really thorough and comprehensive account, but also doesn't really deal with this side at all. It's throwaway lines. We wanted to bring it right into the center of the analysis. That's why we had Ian McLean on the team.
And I mean, just to pick up on, I think, a couple of the reforms which I think lots of people will be very interested to hear and what your take on them was. So like from 97 onwards, you had more of a move towards the kind of fixed medium term budget ceilings. There was also the move to kind of resource accounting and resource budgeting. Like, were there any kind of reflections on that, or the kind of shift to in the kind of OBR, the kind of Office of Budget Responsibility out of government, in terms of kind of setting up that fiscal council? Like, did these fundamentally change the way that public spending was controlled, or was that, do you think that was one of more down to the kind of politics of the day?
Well, you've put several things sure. into that question, and the answer might be different for some of the different ones. In the case of accrual accountings, or accounting, or resource accounting, as it was called, in Britain, resource accounting and budgeting, indeed, it made less of a difference than had been hoped, I think. And that's because the case for resource or accrual accounting is very clear. The idea is that if you adopt that system, there's much less incentive for spending units to hold on to things they don't really need, to neglect maintenance, to run up end-year spending surges, all these things we know about. They're sort of standard behaviours in public expenditure. And the case for resource accounting is precisely that it would enable and indeed reward managers for using resources more efficiently, such that they could release extra spendable cash by, for example, sweating assets or reducing depreciation. There's a very good argument for that. The problem is that in the UK, we'd seen resource accounting or accruals accounting in local government way back, and it came into the National Health Service in the early 90s. And in those cases, it's not a major problem, but in the case of the civil service, and this is described in chapter 10 of our book, by the time that resource accounting and budgeting came in fully, the money was beginning to run out. So there was beginning to be more fiscal stress in the system. And resource accounting and budgeting was seized upon by departmental finance directors and ministers too, as a way to release more spendable cash for themselves. And there's a vignette in chapter 10 that describes what the Ministry of Defence, always a bit of a problem child for the Treasury, what it did with resource accounting and budgeting. The Ministry of Defence, for any of you who know it, will I hope agree, is a deep detail department. It doesn't do things superficially, and its finance unit went into the rules of resource accounting in great detail, taking very careful advice from the Treasury. And a month or so before the Iraq war started, it, note the timing, it presented its spending team, which it took totally by surprise, so it is said in the reports that I've read and in the people that we interviewed, it announced plans to extend the lifetime of some of its assets, you know, like these budget airlines that extend the depreciation on their planes to show a higher profit. The MOD announced a series of changes of that type that would reduce over time about £1 billion of spendable cash a year to the department. Now, viewed from a pure resource accounting framework, you might say, well, this is fine. This is just what the resource accounting is supposed to do, supposed to get people to use assets more efficiently. But at that time, of course, the government was operating with a fiscal spending rule, which was set in cash, because it was on national accounts classification. Because of that, it was simply not affordable. So you had then a series of other departments doing the same kind of thing, because it became obvious that this was a way that RAB could be useful. And what the Treasury had to do in the face of this, which in a sense was, you know, the system working as it was supposed to work, but it just wasn't affordable in terms of the spending rules that the Treasury had adopted. So what the Treasury eventually had to do was to have separate control totals for cash and near cash. So you've actually destroyed the incentives to use assets more efficiently. So great idea, but the way that it worked out was not successful. And because the Treasury put up these spending walls to stop the cash running away, that was a big idea that didn't have a big effect, but it was still bitterly remembered by many of the Treasury people we interviewed, even 15, 20 years later. So that's an example of one of the big ideas of how to make public spending better organized, not having quite the full effect that was hoped for. I mean, there were some things that it definitely did deliver. It meant that we could have whole of government accounts of a reasonably sophisticated nature. And that's very important information if you're interested in, you know, what the prospects are for the future and what the balance sheet looks like. But as I say, the budget, it was the budgeting bit of resource accounting that brought the system down, and it's still, and I think it's still in that state as far as I know.
I mean, as you'll see from that kind of, that just that kind of one area, I think that what the book really does well, and I think I really kind of do encourage you to go back to this like later, but you'll get a sort of snapshot that any area we could spend probably, you know, sort of a full 90 minutes on. I think what might be nice is let me go to Andrew online, because I think he's going to kind of take us into some of the areas where, so the you know, picking up on some of these kind of specific themes from the book and how they relate to South Africa. But like, just as a bit of context, South Africa in the kind of late 90s, early 2000s was very active in kind of copying and learning from the UK case, which is one of the reasons why we've been very keen for Andrew to be part of the conversation. Let me check. Is Andrew online? Yeah. Hi, Andrew. Sorry, I couldn't see your picture. And so what I was going to do, Andrew, is like, maybe you could just tell us very briefly, like, why it was that you were looking at the UK at that time. And then sort of a second question, which is sort of, if you'd have read this book in the early 2000s or the late 90s, what are the kind of lessons that you wish you might have known then for how you might have done things differently?
Thank you. Sid, let me first say that what Professor Hood and his co-writers have done here is lift to the surface things that certainly I, and I'm sure many others working in public finance management in many countries, take for granted. And I think it's very helpful to think of it as a constitution in the sense, as Professor Hood has emphasized, in the sense of a coherent order of things. And it's important to do that because it isn't necessarily the case that the decisions that get taken, the regulations that get written, the reforms that get implemented, it isn't necessarily the case that they will all add up to a coherent system at a point in time, because these are instrumentalities. The officials responsible for writing the rules, for participating in the budget process, or controlling particular kinds of expenditure, or introducing public-private finance initiatives and so on, are not necessarily thinking about the possible unintended consequences of those changes. And so what the book does very nicely is illustrates in some cases how there were unintended consequences, because Hood has just talked about one. But there are also sometimes tensions or trade-offs in the systems that we adopt. So for example, Comprehensive expenditure reviews, clearly a strong feature of the UK system, and Siad, we certainly in South Africa in the late 1990s, as we began to talk about the huge shifts in priority and restructuring of spending that had to happen, bringing together a fragmented fiscal system, 14 ethnic authorities, different education systems. But also a shift to a new government with very different priorities, shrinkage of its defense spending, expansion of its social commitments, progress towards greater equity in social investment, and so on. Comprehensiveness of spending reviews was important. We wanted to get a picture of the system as a whole, but comprehensiveness comes to some extent at the cost of the more detailed, focused emphasis on what might be important in, say, education or industrial subsidies or particular areas. So there's a trade-off there. There's a trade-off between top-down reform, top-down management of expenditure, and the bottom-up, more detailed processes that have to go into expenditure planning and management. And of course, as we know, if countries get that balance between top-down envelope decision making consistent with macroeconomic projections and outlook, get the balance wrong between that and the details of spending allocations, particularly in a fragmented system, things can go very, very badly wrong. So the Constitution is enormously important, and I certainly learned some interesting things about how they fit together and have been evolved, how expenditure control arrangements have evolved over time in the UK. And I saw some interesting parallels with changes that we introduced. So, just to get to the reforms of the late 1990s, here, South Africa going through a very extensive review of its public finance arrangements in the context of democratic transition in 1994. Needed to pay attention to the whole of its public finances. So that comprehensiveness of the expenditure perspective was certainly something we drew on quite strongly. We had the benefit of a lot of international advice at that in those circumstances. South Africa was of interest everywhere. The IMF was around, the World Bank, the OECD, many countries. But we had the benefit of a series of expert advisors seconded from the UK Treasury, also from the US Treasury, who played a critical role in joining us in assessing the changes that needed to be made, but also in advising on international experience. And when you're making changes, you do run the risk of unintended consequences and things that don't work out well, as I've talked about. And so drawing on that international experience is enormously important. This book is very useful in that. And of course, the role that international public finance management reform initiatives and engagements play is vital in many countries. I'll just talk about two or three things about things that we might have got done better. This was your second part of your questions here, if we had known a little more. And one of them relates to resource accounting and the better information that comes with more detailed accrual-based accounting. We did not implement a full accrual-based accounting system in national and provincial government, but we did in the early 2000s implement essentially a full accrual-based accounting system for local government. And that made the integration of local government accounts with our provincial and national public finance account system very difficult. And so there's some complexities in public finance management associated with it. But also we implemented these reforms without much of the kind of expenditure management capacity that is needed to go with a full accrual-based accounting. And in some respects, the consequences for our local government financial arrangement and financial management have been, I'll put it as strongly as this, catastrophic. Not everywhere, but certainly in parts of the municipal system. We're getting that balance right between direct, if you like, blunt cash control Ensuring that the revenue that comes that is written to the books of the municipality is actually collected, that spending flows to where it should. There are enormous gaps in much of our municipal financial system in financial management that I think would have been better managed, a transition that would have been more effectively undertaken if we had not been quite so ambitious in shifting to full accrual-based resource accounting in our municipal management environment. And I think if we'd had the opportunity to perhaps learn a little more from international experience there before those reforms, we might have done better. And then if I can make one other point about comprehensiveness of spending, because this is quite a strong emphasis in the book. It's certainly an important feature, as Professor Hood has talked about, of the UK system and the financial management everywhere. I learned some things about what this means in the UK Treasury from the book that I hadn't understood before. There's an important distinction between the kinds of spending controls that are applied to expenditure limits over a medium-term expenditure framework. We implemented much of that in the late 1990s when we shifted from a one-year budgeting system to a three-year medium-term budgeting system. In the UK, there's an important distinction in these expenditure controls between what is called the departmental expenditure limits, which are contracted over a period of time, and what is called annually managed expenditure. Now, that's a difficult distinction. We didn't try to do that, and I think quite rightly. I think you give some good examples of how that distinction is difficult to maintain, and really it's not a binary thing. There are a wide range of different kinds of time spans of spending, and they don't always fit tidily into that distinction. But so we opted for a single overall level of expenditure control over departments and negotiations between departments and the Treasury around their expenditure limits within a single aggregate rather than broken down in that way. But what the UK does in its expenditure, in its departmental expenditure limits, in requiring departments to consolidate their spending with the arm's length agencies, or what we call public entities that are associated with departments, so that you have a full picture of spending, including agencies associated with the department, and indeed for the wider public finances, for the macro position, and a budget deficit that is defined to include the net borrowing requirements of state-owned companies of the wider public sector. That's a reform we've not done, and we would be in a far better place relative to our present debt management position. We would be in a far better place in respect of the imbalances in remuneration levels, in controls over expenditure and inputs, and in the overall control of public expenditure if we had implemented expenditure controls across departments, consolidated with their entities, and in a framework of debt management in which net borrowing requirements of state-owned companies was part of the public sector borrowing requirement as the headline deficit. So there's some examples of things we might have done better if we'd understood enough in advance. But I do want to say there's a lot more to expenditure control and a lot of interesting examples of the kinds of things that can assist in getting things right. And if I can just finish with one last point on that, there's a very interesting discussion, Professor Hood, towards the end of the book about the relational distance between both Treasury officials and the departmental officials they work with, and between different parts of the Treasury, those who are responsible for policy and expenditure controls, those who are responsible perhaps for accounting advice and accounting standards, and getting the balance right between those different kinds of professional expertise, how they work together, how often they talk to each other, and what their relationships are between Treasury officials, the different components of Treasury officials and external departments, is about cultural and institutional dimensions of the fiscal constitution that we don't talk about enough, but are often hugely important to successful budget reforms and successful expenditure management.
That was really, really nicely put. And I think the kind of two themes of kind of comprehensiveness and the kind of relational distance, I think they do kind of run, I think, also really nicely through the book. I mean, I'm gonna also now go to Yasmin and ask kind of a fairly similar question, which is sort of, you know, you're working in Southeastern Europe. Southeastern Europe faces sort of various pressures, whether through kind of donor projects, whether through external advice, whether through its kind of ambitions to join the EU, essentially efforts to kind of modernize public financial management systems. And very much, I think, again, the kind of UK is seen as a template for areas like public investment management, like medium-term budgeting reforms. And so again, sort of, you know, with your, from your perspective and from your kind of where you sit, like, again, what would be the kind of lessons and the takeaways that you took away from what was in the book?
Thank you very much, Sirit. First, it's a pleasure to be with you in this event. Let me answer your question. Of course, the UK is often a leading example for PFM reforms. So there are definitely lessons from UK's reform experiences that the countries I work with could benefit from. I want to give some background. I, together with another IMF colleague, cover six Balkan countries, namely Albania, Bosnia, Kosovo, North Macedonia, Montenegro, and Serbia in the Southeast Europe region. As you rightly indicated, there is considerable pressure on these countries to modernize the PFM system as part of the EU accession process, in addition to the internal pressures. Their heavy PFM reform agenda, supported by different donors, and broader economic agenda to achieve macroeconomic stability and long-term sustainability. Also, due to the importance of the EU accession process, our capacity development CD activities, also funded by financial support from EU, as well as State Secretariat for Economic Affairs, SECO, for the broader structural reform priorities. So the PFM reform priorities that we work together with my with our counterparts in the region include making medium-term budget process or MTBFs more credible, strengthening the public investment management PIM systems, improving fiscal risk disclosure, analysis and management, as well as improving budget execution and cash management. So during our CD missions, capacity development missions, the countries are always interested in hearing from other countries' experiences. Of course, as we were talking, Professor Hood and Andrew also mentioned that while looking for country examples, we need to remember that each country is peculiar due to their own unique fiscal constitution, if I may use the same terminology as in the book. So their political, bureaucratic structures, administrative culture or traditions, and their formal and informal rules and procedures vary significantly. One reform step or method working well in one country might not work in another country. Having said that, if we understand the reasoning behind and the motivation behind these reforms conducted in different countries, we can learn or inspire from these examples and adapt some aspects of these reforms into the local country context. So in that sense, the book is also is very useful. So after this long introduction, let me highlight five UK PFM reforms mentioned in the book that my counterparts in the region and all PFM experts could benefit from. First reform is public investment management, as you rightly said, Sirt. Rationalization of investment planning and how project and PIM decisions inject in more rationality and multi-stage gateway process in the system. The book nicely shows how PIM planning has evolved to prevent political influences. And indeed, the UK government has been perceived as a standard setter for project appraisal methodology, starting with the earliest versions of the Green Book. If there is anybody in the audience does not know the Green Book, it is a guidance provided by the Treasury for public sector bodies on how to appraise proposals before committing funds. And it's a great reference for the countries. So the book has, Green Book has informed similar frameworks in other countries and could continue doing so for the countries in the Southeast Europe region as an example of leading practice internationally. The countries we work with have often faced with low budget execution in capital spending and cost and time overruns due to the weaknesses in their PIM planning and especially the appraisal stage. So therefore, this is the most important UK reform that could help the countries in the Southeast Europe region. So related to the PIM topic, the book also talks about the public-private partnerships, private finance instruments, as you call. So as the book shows, UK faced issues related to PPPs and use them mainly due to their off-balance sheet nature. These types of projects are believed by some people to be more efficient than traditional public investment without calculating all the risks around them. They are generally used to keep government spending and liabilities out of headline measures of the deficit and debt, which creates problems for the management of fiscal risks. So there is a larger topic to discuss in another event, perhaps, but I want to highlight that my counterparts could benefit from how the UK at least has improved the transparency around these contracts. Currently in the UK, the implications of PPPs for public finances are disclosed. As indicated in the 2016 IMF Fiscal Transparency Evaluation, following the Eurostat rules, the Office of National Statistics published an estimate value of PPPs, PFIs. The Treasury publishes projected government payments in PPPs by project for every year of each project's life. And the OBR also cover these contracts in their publications. Therefore, the countries could learn from how the transparency in PPPs improved and implemented in UK. So the second reform area is medium-term budgeting. I think there is something wrong with my video. Can you see me? Okay, can you hear me as well?
We can hear you well.
Okay, good. The second reform I was talking about, the medium-term budgeting, MTBF. The strategic top-down planning needs further strengthening in Southeast Europe region. Therefore, the UK's long-established multi-year budget framework, or MTBF, based on multi-year spending agreements undertaking during comprehensive spending reviews, could be an example for the countries working on the MTBF reforms, including baseline estimates. Many of my countries also interested in these baseline estimates nowadays. So the 2016 IMF Fiscal Transparency Evaluation again shows that the UK has a strong record of delivering its medium-term commitments on the expenditure side. In addition to budget preparation stage or MTBF reforms, during the budget execution, the countries could also benefit from in-year budget controls and the carry-over rules, carry-forward rules implemented in the UK. There is generally an end-of-year rush in budget spending in the countries that we work together with. So the UK's end-year flexibility and carryover rules in that sense could be really helpful to look at. Our counterparts or yourself joining us today might want to look at the consolidated budgeting guidance published on the HM Treasury website on this topic. So third reform area I would like to highlight is related to categorization and classification issues. The book nicely also shows how creative classification, Professor Hood also mentioned that creative classification has been persistent in the UK system, and it was part of the developments in public spending over the period. So this is true in other countries as well. Categorization and classification problems can be created intentionally, as indicated in the book, but they can also be the result of limited knowledge on the subject. Regardless of the reasons behind, they avoid governments take better fiscal policy decisions. In the region, there are also, in the Southeast Europe region, there are also sectorization or categorization and classification issues, especially related to categorization of some public corporations and adequate classification of capital spending. On the classification issues, the book nicely shows how standardization through adapting the international standards, in UK case, ESA 10 and Eurostat procedures, resulted in the removal of discretion over statistical definitions from the Treasury. So similar footsteps towards implementing the international statistical standards will also help the accession countries solve their classification-related challenges. Also on the categorization or sectorization issue, the Office of National Statistics institution categorization exercise can be useful for the countries in the region. The sector classification of bodies assessed by the ONS is published in the sector classification guide. The Treasury also published a guidance note on sector classification. So these issues and the UK's experience covered by the book and useful material shared by the Treasury and the ONS could be really helpful for my counterparts in the region. Fourth area is the Office of Budget Responsibility as an example for Fiscal Council. As discussed in the book, macroeconomic forecasting is crucial for fiscal policy, and also it is one of the biggest risks. Since fiscal councils are required for member countries under the EU rules, the accession countries are also interested in these watchdog institutions recently. That even there are some countries in the region want to establish fiscal council. So therefore, the accession countries could benefit from the UK's experience in this field, and in addition to the experience of the other EU member countries with the fiscal councils. And fifth area, last but not least, the number of detailed manuals, guidance notes published in the HM Treasury page is something to learn from. These materials are very important for the PFM practitioners in the UK, but also for those in other countries. All those materials, including now the Professor Hood and the other authors' book, are very useful for the HM Treasury staff as well as broader PFM readers. There's a high staff turnover in the countries we work with in the region, but unfortunately, you can hardly find any written materials about their fiscal constitutions as well as business processes in the PFM system. The book also mentions about the high staff turnover at the HM Treasury, but these written materials are crucial for the continuity of the daily work in the bureaucracy and for the fiscal constitution. This is why we frequently refer to the UK as a leading example of PFM reforms. We could find materials about the reforms. So thank you very much thank you very much, Professor Hood and the other authors for this new edition and the useful material. With that, back to you, Steve. Thank you.
Thanks. That was quite the run of issues. And I think a lot of my takeaway from those is that it's kind of there's at times a kind of optimistic slant on the things that you kind of learn in the journey, right? I think many of the areas, whether it was PFI or the NDA flexibilities, they're kind of raised very much in the book as kind of initiatives that were either sort of part of the kind of gaming culture or kind of subject later to gaming, and then the kind of response to that. So I think that's kind of really interesting. And I think also this point at the end about just kind of why this book actually was even started was kind of very much part of the kind of Treasury's conscious like decision to try and enhance knowledge management and document kind of period history. Sorry about that. So I think both are really kind of really, really useful points. I'm conscious that we're kind of definitely running through the hour. And I'd like to open up to kind of some questions, but there's a couple of questions that have come in online that I've got sort of related theme, but like maybe sort of in the room and elsewhere, if you've kind of got thoughts or questions you'd like to pose, please kind of indicate. But just two that have come up online, one from Alia Fouad, who's the current economic regulator at Liberia's Regulatory Commission, but also from Mark Halliburg, at Hertie School. I mean, both of them have a kind of political take on this, which is, so Mark's question was the extent that individual chancellors put their stamp on the system, and whether they sort of first came into office and kind of assessed how things were working, or whether they kind of came in with kind of prearranged plans. And from Alia, the question is how much the kind of evolution of the Treasury can be attributed to the essentially the kind of political changes at number 10. And I suppose I think within that you'd put like the changes in political parties probably as well. And if there's any kind of takeaways you take from that for other countries, he's asked, which is I think a kind of a next step in that, and I thought an already difficult question, but maybe we start with that, the kind of politics of the kind of spending process.
Yes, I think that each chancellor, finance minister, puts their stamp on the system, and they come from different areas. So you find some chancellors who have been chief secretaries earlier in their careers, Norman Lamont, for example, before they come to the chancellorship. And so they know more about how business is done in the Treasury. So that's one thing that I would say would definitely be a variation. Have they previously served as chief secretary at the sharp end of all this, where the money is decided? And we interviewed most of the chief secretaries of the period. That's the second minister in the Treasury underneath the Chancellor. But chancellors themselves come from very different backgrounds. For example, early in our period, Ken Clark had been minister of practically everything. I mean, he'd served in many big departments, including being minister of health. And so he had the experience of the introduction of resource accounting, accrual accounting in the NHS, and he thought that it was great because he knew where all the surplus land was, you know, in hospitals around the country that could be sold off to advantage. And he had a lot, and he actually spent, this is on the record, I'm not betraying any confidence, he spent his holidays writing about how the Treasury should deal with departments, because he had felt as a spending minister that, you know, the Treasury is too high-handed and so on. So I think that's the other kind of way that chancellors can affect the conduct of the Treasury. And with Clark, it was absolutely clear. He was the one who was keen to press on with resource accounting. And the other question that's sort of been raised in that is the relationship with the Prime Minister. Yes, of course, one of the ways to play the the spending review game is to play the Prime Minister against the Chancellor, and that's always going to be the case in any parliamentary system. I don't think anyone's invented a way around that yet. And you see, we give some quite dramatic examples in the book, including the famous Breakfast with Frost program that took place in 2000, in which Tony Blair committed to massively raise spending in healthcare without, so it is said, consulting the Treasury. And by the way, the Minister of Health had been at that time, I just add this as additional information, had been Chief Secretary of the Treasury only a few weeks before that famous thing, that famous TV programme. So yes, of course the Prime Minister is absolutely crucial in the process. And it's the Prime Minister that decides how the Cabinet is going to decide on the allocation. For example, is the Cabinet going to discuss taxation along with spending, or is that going to be, do they take them in order? All this stuff about, you know, committees and how they work, orders of agendas, etc., really crucial. Of course that's important, no question.
I mean, I think again, we could probably spend a long time on all of this. I mean, there are a couple of things I mentioned just for Alia that kind of stood out to me. Were, I mean, one, that you get a lot of the kind of clear breaks tend to happen around changes in government. I mean, the New Labour in particular brought in a range of kind of new changes to the kind of spending framework at that time.
But almost all of them had been in the works
exactly
before.
Okay. Yeah,
and. We talked to chief secretaries and chancellors from all parties, and I certainly remember a Conservative chief secretary who said we'd have done PSAs if we'd won the 1997 election, and they thought that it was already in the works. And the same was true with resource accounting. It was, as I've said, it was Ken Clark that pushed that one on. But it was under the subsequent New Labour government that that it actually came into operation.
Any other questions? Go on, Philip.
Yeah.
And then Mark.
So Thane and Wright in their book, Passing Judgment. I think both at the beginning and the end, they're sort of saying these are the questions that we're using to interrogate Treasury between 1976, I think, and 1992, and are very clear that in their assessment, this is sort of a record of failure, that what Treasury tried to do, and by any measure that you could apply, things didn't work. And you and your book sort of refrain from passing judgment, as it were. And I was wondering, and this is mostly for you, Christopher, were you not tempted to gloat a little bit? Because you were writing about new public management in the 1990s, and if you're reading the book, almost everything that is new public management that was happening over this period ended up not working and ended up being discontinued or very strongly changed. That would have been an amazing opportunity at the end for you to say, I could have told you this a long, long time ago. Or is it that maybe Barbara and Maya stayed your hand and said, nobody cares about new public management anymore, and we don't even know what that means?
Thanks. And Mike, you had a question as well. I'll come to you, Adrian.
Yes, it's partly to try and introduce a bit more of an international dimension. Let me say that I recognize a lot of things where Professor Hood said about the importance of the minister coming in. Following on from Ken Clark, of course, we had Gordon Brown. Ken Clark was laid back, delegated, set the agenda, don't bother to do anything else. Gordon Brown wanted to do it all himself. Treasury officials weren't able even to talk to their opposite numbers in departments. And that was a big change. But I wanted to pick up on one other thing you said. I'm not sure if we realize in the UK just how flexible our legislative framework is. I mean, in my last 5 years in the Treasury, where I had sort of 30 odd years, I was head of the UK Debt Management Office, and our legislation basically had some very high level objectives, and I could do what I like, providing I could sort of vaguely link it to one of those objectives. Yes, there's very strong ex post audit, which is with the PAC, which is very important. But many of the countries I work with around the world, and I particularly have in mind Latin America, Southeast Asia, have a highly detailed legislative framework within which they have to operate. And when they think about reform, they start from the legislation and they write policy papers that are all about the legislation. And the contrast between that and the UK, where we decide what we want to do and then wonder if we need any legislation to allow us to do it, is very stark. South Africa is probably nearer to the UK than some of the countries I mentioned. One thing, and of course I'm biased in this, having been in the DMO where we integrated debt and cash management, and that's one thing South Africa have done in the National Treasury very successfully. It's a problem, it's much more of a problem in some of the countries that Yasmin deals with, and I've been very pleased to be able to work with Yasmin a number of times in recent years, where there's quite a strong treasury that creates boundary issues. Here I'm talking, of course, about the treasury function rather than the Ministry of Finance, but there are boundary issues with the budget department, quite where the budget preparation and budget execution, how that divides. But one of the other boundary issues is that in many of these countries, recognizing the importance of debt management, that has been spun out as a separate directorate general level, which is sensible for managing debt, but at a cost of inadequate, often, coordination between the debt and cash management functions. So I know this is taking us slightly beyond the focus of the discussion today, but I think we need to think about the financing element of the expenditure as well as what's happening above the line. Sorry, that's not really a question. I can add a question mark at the end.
Thanks. And then I think there's one question over here from Adrian.
Adrian Hewitt. I'd like to put a question to Andrew Donaldson if he's still available. We had a bit of a freeze frame for a while, but yeah, great. Hi. I wanted to ask him, our paper says he left the Treasury 6 years ago. Has the National Treasury got a grip on state-owned enterprises since, and how did it do it?
Cool, thanks. So there's also a couple of questions online. One which I don't think was as big a theme of the book as some of your past work was on digital and sort of the kind of nature of the fact that more services are becoming digital and whether kind of that came up in your conversations and the issues around spending control and kind of spending efficiency. And a last one on the relationship between politics and the administration, and so the kind of nature of whether that relationship has kind of changed in any way over the period that you saw, because I think people sort of, I think the kind of context of it is sort of seeing the UK as having one where there's kind of an impartial civil service, but I guess the kind of question is whether the, how that actually plays out in practice and kind of the nature of spending control. But maybe we can start, maybe while you're gathering your thoughts, I'll kind of start with Andrew on the kind of state-owned enterprises and your kind of perception of how the kind of control and kind of treasury engagement with state-owned enterprises has kind of evolved in South Africa.
Well, thank you. It's good to see you, Adrian. I mean, you were involved in the secondments to South Africa many years ago. That's when we last met. And so it's you've given me a tough question. No, I don't think that we have made anywhere near enough progress in modernizing the relationship between Treasury and state-owned companies. We still have, as you know, a Department of Public Enterprises. So there's a Department of Public Enterprises that does much of the relationship between government and the large state-owned companies. They are for the most part in big trouble. So South Africa has a huge problem in the balance sheet of its energy supply utility, which has not modernized, and in more recent years has also had to deal with a sort of collapse of delivery in some respects, but also balance sheet problems in the big transport utility. And I think the proper answer to your question is that this is much less about the traditional treasury aspects of expenditure control or debt management, much more about very long delayed and contested reform. So we had white papers on restructuring our electricity industry 25 years ago, which we're just now beginning to implement. And in some respects, we can tell a similar story about the big rail industry and its decline over the last decade or so. There are many parts to the story. Fraud and corruption is one part of it. Sort of failed interventions from the Treasury, trying to set conditions attached to financial assistance or bailouts, but also policy disputes about the reform process, which have held back progress. So like many countries faced with a fiscal consolidation challenge, we look back and see how financial support that has been necessary to state-owned companies is one of the big reasons why we're in a fiscal consolidation crunch at the moment. And no, we've still got work to do in answer to your question in resolving that.
I guess over to you on the kind of question on new public management and digital, which I guess are not exactly the same, but they're sort of somewhat related.
Well, I doubt if I can give a very satisfactory answer to either, but maybe Maya and Barbara can think up something. I think it wasn't so much gloating as seeing from the inside what I had only seen from the outside before. As I hope is explained in the book, it's heavily dependent on interviews. And so I learned much more about what the people who operated the measures I'd been writing about in the 90s, what was animating them and how they saw the procedure. So it certainly gave me a different perspective, without question. Whether I gloated, well, I don't know. Perhaps when I knew more about what was going on inside, I could see more why it was inevitable, but I don't know that I would want to go out too far on a limb on that. On the question about flexible legislation, I think that's a very good point that you're making there. Some of the interesting interviews we did were with people from the Treasury Officer of Accounts, because they're the people who spend their time, as I think it was described to me, schmoozing with the PAC. And there's this arrangement. I don't know whether it's widespread internationally, perhaps you know, where there's this concordat between the Treasury and the Public Accounts Committee, 1931 or something like that. Yeah, which allows for proposals for policy to go ahead before the legislation or spending to be incurred before the enabling legislation is in place. And I was told that there were at least several rows every week about this issue. It's, you know, it's quite a not a bit of, that's written about, but, and I was also told, I don't know whether this would or the you'd have a view on this, was that one of the reasons why it's been so difficult historically to get a proactive expenditure committee off the ground in the House of Commons is because of this cozy arrangement about approving new legislation, plus all the rest of the functions that the PAC has, some of which would have to be given up in the event of a strong expenditure committee being formed. I don't know whether you have a view on that, but I was certainly told that.
The PAC has been embedded for much, much longer, of course. I mean, these expenditure committees didn't start happening until the 70s.
And, oh yes, the question about digital arrangements. I mean, our period went back to the early 90s, which is unimaginably far back in terms of technology. I remember interviewing one of the messengers, you know, the human emails that were operating at that time. Just another world. And this gentleman, he was a school leaver. He was chatting away with the chancellors and the like when delivering these human emails. You know, all that's gone. And likewise, you know, you've moved away from paper files and the apparatus that went along with that, typists, all gone. One of the things that I think might flow from that, apart from something no one's mentioned today, but which I would want to put a plug in for, the institutional memory problem, apart from the institutional memory problem, I think it's probably altered the class composition of the Treasury, in the sense that there are fewer, as you might say, working class people around the place, as a matter of fact, along with following the fundamental expenditure review of the early 90s, a less top, less middle heavy, shall we say, department, average age 29 or whatever it is, it's something like that. So I think that the digital issue is very interesting. It affects us because there are questions about how easy it's going to be in the future to access Treasury files and archives in the future, either for policy or for academic curiosity. Because having seen some of these archives and files from the inside, it's going to be really tough.
Okay, so we'll have one more question, I think, two if they're kind of related, but we're coming up to time, so keep them short. No, don't worry, you're not related, but the questions hopefully will be, and if not, we'll find a way to kind of answer them quickly.
Thank you. I wanted to ask a question about gaming. In your remarks, you talked a bit about the gaming of the accrual budgeting rules by the Ministry of Defence in kind of recent budgets. It's the Treasury itself that's been criticised for gaming the fiscal rules by putting in clearly unrealistic spending forecasts to create fiscal space for tax cuts. So should we be more worried about Ministry of Finance gaming or more worried about line ministry gaming?
I suppose slightly related. Do you know how much money all these government departments, etc., I used to be a councillor and other things, waste on bank charges? And maybe if we had a Bank of Britain that for all public finance, you could use things related to what you've all been talking about, see how expenditure monitors expenditure through bank charges. Because I know my council spent, I don't know, £500,000 on bank charge, something ridiculous. I mean, it's only a little council, Kingston. And all the other London boroughs must also spend millions on bank charges. And that's just London. And if you think about all the other schools, hospitals and everything else, it's quite a lot of money wasted on bank charges. Whereas if we had a national Bank of Britain of some sort, you could use it for all your statistical stuff as well and monitoring. So that's it. Thank you.
macro question on a macro question on what kinds of gaming we should be most worried about, and I suppose a micro level question about what kinds of issues around inefficiencies kind of cropped up perhaps most, and whether the kind of bank charges were in any way related. But
I don't think, well, I'll stand to be corrected if my colleagues think this is wrong. I don't think the issue was mentioned by any of the 130 people we interviewed, so you'd be on original ground there. As far as the gaming issue, well, practically all of them talked about gaming in some way or another. It's a way of life in and around the Treasury, almost. And you know, they would talk openly about things like one fiddle rules. You know, it just got one fiddle into a spending review. You know, that was really honest. and in terms of types of gaming, yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think hadn't quite struck me anyway, I don't know about my colleagues before I got into all this, was that what we were continually doing was inventing new kinds of spending around the classification. So we begin with things like lottery money, not under Treasury control. So you created a new kind of public spending that isn't quite public spending, and then you've got the private finance issue that's been written about so much. Another area of spending that isn't spending. Then we turn grant funding of universities and students into fees and loans. Lending isn't spending, so that doesn't count as spending either. And so what we see over this period is a continual invention of new types of spending on quite a big scale. Most of them get shot down in time, but by no means all. And there's always the risk that you're going to end up with the more fragmented system that doesn't have the same comprehensiveness that everyone says has been traditional about UK public finances. But I think there's certainly been a move away from that, and that might well be worrying.
Brilliant, thanks. I'm going to draw this to a close, just mainly for the people online, so that they can, because we're at the end of the time. That we can more than continue this conversation outside for those who are in the room, and I'm sure there's kind of going to be lots to pick up on, not least the many anecdotes around fiddling rules and gaming, which is always a good topic for continuing. I mean, first I just want to say, like, this, you know, that clearly this is like a really, really important like piece of work, and you know, I think, you know, big credit to Christopher, Maya, Barbara, Ian for the work that's gone into this, and for a really excellent book. I think, you know, many people, hopefully this gives a bit of a flavor for what's in it, but like ultimately, that, you know, if you're interested in UK public finance, this is going to be a really fantastic resource. Second point, as I was saying, if you've kind of enjoyed the kind of spirit of this conversation and the kinds of things that we're looking at, if you're interested to engage in that kind of future conversations and kind of further events as part of the series, the next set will be closed door, so please just get in touch with myself or Danielle Cerebro at ODI, and we'll include you in the mailing list as we kind of set that up. But we're kind of moving away from a kind of public event kind of approach, and we're going to have more kind of closed door, lets a bit more interaction with online audience as well. And then, you know, finally, I guess just to say thanks for everyone making the time and for joining online. I know many people have joined from all over the world at different times of the day. A lot of people travel from far out of town as well. And Christopher and Andrew and Yasmin, for kind of dedicating your time to help kind of engage with us today. So thanks very much. And thanks for joining.